Welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Tom Edwards. Now, it's been a big week for the film industry as the 2017 Oscar nominees were announced on Tuesday. Who's up for the big gongs? Well, to talk me through the list, as well as three films out in the cinema this week, some of which may have featured in the Oscar nominations, I'm joined by film critic Jason Solomons. Jason, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tom.
You're looking fairly fresh-faced. This is kind of a knackering week, isn't it? For a man in your line of business.
It's also my favourite week of the year as well, because it's sort of in demand and people discuss films like they were news as well. So, you know, it's a rare moment that we can get to do it as well. And then you get a newsworthy thing like La La Land equaling the record for 14 mm-hmm. Oscar nominations, which with equals All About Eve, which was a great film, and it equals Titanic, which is rubbish. So okay. there's no real sort of good, well, it that, doesn't mean anything.
That prompts me to ask you where on that spectrum then does this fall, because it has received there's been a sort of warmth, I guess, in the criticism about La La Land, which I think we've talked before about, you know, Hollywood loves films about Hollywood, and this is a little bit of that.
It is a lot of that.
Is it warranted? I mean, we need a bit of feel-good, don't we, at the moment?
I think we do need a little bit of... I think everyone needs a bit of La La Land in their life. And I've been sort of diagnosing it to friends, as sort of who kind of go, I can't believe that, you know, America's got a wall, and or whatever ill is your choice. La La Land, it seems to me the salve for it. I wouldn't make any greater claims than that. It's not going to change your life. I think it's a lovely little film. I think it's sad and funny. It makes me dance. I love the leads. I love it. I think it's terrific. And I think that, you know, it takes its place in the kind of dance steps of musicals history. So, yes, I'm glad it's got a record. Is it worth 14 Oscar nominations? I mean, you know, is a footballer worth 35 million? It's as much as you want to pay for it, in a way.
Absolutely.
I love it. It can't live up to that hype. It won't win 14. Don't worry. It's not going to sweep the board like Return of the King.
So, in a way, I guess on Oscar night, it's sort of maybe a bit of an anticlimax.
Yeah, I mean, as much as the nominations were, when halfway through it got to eight and you thought, well, maybe this is going to go for the record. That's not going to happen on Oscar night, I don't think. I think there are other films in this now tricky period, this sort of campaigning period, as we know, never predict politics. Last year taught us nothing but that. There are other things that could come along and maybe trip it up. You know, Casey Affleck will probably beat Ryan Gosling to Best Actor, so that's one down. Will it win a screenplay award? Probably not for original screenplay. I mean, I like the writing, but I think there are sort of, I think Kenneth Longan's Manchester by the Sea, again, probably will win a screenplay for that. And if you don't win screenplay, you often don't win in several other categories. That's the history of it. So, yeah, but I think it will win Best Picture. Yes, I do.
Okay. And just one other thing about the Oscars. I mean, I don't, perhaps we talked about this before. The Oscars courted some controversy last year. People said it was too white and that this reflected a sort of latent or a quite explicit racism within the sort of movie community. I don't know if that's been overcome. They certainly haven't shrugged that off completely, but it's good to see lots of black faces amongst the nominees. A concerted effort, or finally the Academy just recognising good performances?
Yeah,
on their merits.
It's a concerted effort to make the Academy recognise other performances, you could put it that way. I mean, no, racism has not been solved as an issue in America. It wasn't when Obama was.
I've heard a few things about that, yeah.
So, you know, I wish it wouldn't with this case, but 35% of the acting nominees this year are of colour. That includes Dev Patel, who's sort of British and Anglo Indian. Those are all good. Dev Patel's not the best. I mean, it's great for him and I like him very much, but it's not the world's greatest actor to be getting an Oscar nomination, but it's a supporting actor turn. Naomi Harris, who is another Brit nominated, I'm delighted for her, even though she only did 3 days work in Moonlight, but you know, it's a thoroughly deserving, but yes, I think Moonlight is the big beneficiary of this increased radar, I would say. Yes, Cheryl Boone Isaacs changed the Academy very quickly after 2 years of Oscars so white controversy, and that has had an effect, I think, on rescuing a film like Moonlight, where people have seen it, thought, we're sort of looking for a film like this, and now we can promote this film. And it's got 8 Oscar nominations. I think 2 years ago, this film would have been, you know, a little hit at a festival, and people would have liked it very much, and people would have moaned about it not getting wider recognition. But that was the fate of an indie black movie. Now it's kind of up there, and I mean, it more than holds its own. And for me, it's the only film that could possibly trip La La Land up on its dance up the red carpets of the world.
Interesting. Well, the Oscars take place on the 26th of February. They'll be broadcast on ABC in the States, Sky Movies, Oscar Channel here in the UK. We'll all be watching with interest. Let's move on to some cinema releases. And our first film, as I alluded to in the introduction, is 6 times Oscar nominated, including a nod to its director, Mr. Mel Gibson. His last directorial attempt was 2006's Apocalypto, which didn't do too well. Before we talk about Mel Gibson's extraordinary Hollywood rehabilitation, in film terms, Jason, does he redeem himself with Hacksaw Ridge?
Well, not really. I mean, the six nominations for it are as overkill as the film is. It's this film about a conscientious objector, true life story played by Andrew Garfield in the character of Desmond Doss, who is a Seventh-day Adventist and doesn't want to carry a weapon into war. So this is a true story. He went into battle in Okinawa, one of the bloodiest battles in World War II, without holding a gun because he was the medic anyway. So, I mean, I don't know if medics always have guns or not, but he did a lot of carrying injured people out of the battle, like a one-man saviour, lots of people on his back. It reminded me slightly of a Mel Gibson film before, where people have to undergo terrible things to test their faith. You know, the battle scenes are gory and bloody, but not in a kind of really, I mean, in a kind of Hollywood kind of cheesy way, not even Saving Private Ryan way, and that was a long time ago. So Spielberg raised the bar for kind of carnage on the field. This doesn't have it. The faceless hordes of the Japanese doesn't help. I think a modern war movie is more understanding and empathising on the enemy. This doesn't bother with any of that. It just concentrates on this not even all-American hero. It kind of he's sort of a bit anti-establishment in his faith. Mm. He's a stubborn git, if you want, or he's got infused with faith. The two come together, I think, and Mel Gibson is probably the example of that because he's stuck it out, and now he's back nominated for Best Director at the top of the tree.
Well, let's get stuck into this because I still can't quite understand how the Academy, and I suppose Hollywood, if we to use that as an umbrella term, has been so seemingly forgiving, particularly given the specifics of some of what is alleged or admitted that Gibson's done, certainly some of his comments, anti-Semitic remarks and so forth.
Well, yeah, the Holocaust denial he's been accused of.
Why is this how has this happened? I mean, you know this industry and this the funny politics of this community as well as anyone. How do you explain
He's managed to get... I mean, there are... You know, there's a vast amount of money to be made in faith-based movies as well. Big companies like Walden Media, who financed the Narnia movies back in the day, which didn't do great because they were slightly too faith-based, even though C.S. Lewis was a man of great faith. So there's a lot of money to be made. They're not going to ignore that. I mean, Passion of the Christ made a ton of money. Mm. Apocalypto didn't because it was in whatever language that was in yeah. Mayan. So if Mel can harness these things, this is a big American story. We're in a very patriotic time for America, whipped up by Trump, etc. So you need a John Wayne figure now to kind of go back to the Green Beret era. And this is what this sort of film harks back to. Clint Eastwood did it with Flags of Our Fathers, and he did it Letters to Iwo Jima as a kind of companion piece to show it from the Japanese. Even Clint Eastwood, who's hardly Mr. Cuddly, showed it from two sides. Mel doesn't even bother with all that. So I see why it's popular with some. I wonder if the new diverse Hollywood has something to do with it as well. Maybe Hollywood is less Jewish, or the Academy is less Jewish than it was. That may be, I'm not saying there's an anti-Semitic move at all. I just think if you open up to other people and other minorities, they will bring other points of view. Maybe some other cultures find this particularly inspiring. Just from a filmmaking point of view, I found it clunky and unsubtle, very old-fashioned. I mean, it was like watching a film from the early 90s. Directed by Mel Gibson.
There you go. Perhaps we should have expected that. So maybe he's rehabilitated. Who knows?
Well, he might be back. I mean, if they allow him to do a speech at any of these awards, he's not going to win anything. Actually, I don't think. I mean, Andrew Garfield is possible. I find Andrew Garfield a bit weedy, to be honest. I mean, I know he plays a sort of conscientious objector in this, but I found him just very weedy to carry a movie, let alone all the 75 corpses he carries out of the rubble. I didn't believe he could possible doing it. It's Andrew Garfield.
Hacksaw Ridge, if you're still interested, is out now in cinemas around the world. Next up, let's talk about Denial. Well, in a way, that's sort of an easy segue.
It's not easy segue. It's a risky segue, but I love it.
It's based on a book by the American Deborah Lipstadt about her experiences during an extraordinary real-life legal battle with the Briton David Irving, who she declares a Holocaust denier. In order to win her case, she then had to sort of prove the truth that this had happened. We'll hear from you in a minute, Jason. Let's hear a little clip first of all.
Miss Lipstadt has done very real damage to my professional existence.
What did you say about him?
I think I called him a liar and a falsifier of history.
You better get yourself lawyered up.
A man accuses you of something and it's your job to prove he's wrong? In the US, there's a presumption of innocence.
Yeah, not in the UK.
This case is happening to you, but it's not about you.
Auschwitz is at the very center of Holocaust belief, so it's at the very center of Holocaust denial.
There were no gas chambers anywhere at Auschwitz.
But here is one of the largest killing machines in human history.
You know what it is, it's how we prove what it is.
What if we lose? Suddenly it becomes acceptable to say the Holocaust didn't happen?
hearing from denial. Now, Jason, this is clearly a delicate subject. Is it handled with the necessary sort of nuance in this piece?
Yeah, I mean, Holocaust Memorial Day is January the 27th, so Denial comes out in the UK to sort of mark that. And it's sort of a film that has a monumental importance coming to mark a monumental day. Holocaust Denial hasn't disappeared yet, though. Mm. Anyone who remembers the court case that we heard there between David Irving and Deborah Lipstadt and Penguin Books will remember, I don't want to spoil it because it's a big courtroom drama, what's going to happen in the end. But we kind of know David, I don't want to call David Irving a historian. I want to call him disgraced historian because that's what he is. And it's very important that we do that because we're allowed to. Bad historian might even hurt him more. And this is a court case that shows him to do so. Now, he's played brilliantly by Timothy Spall. Lovely Timothy Spall, who was Aubrey in Life is Sweet and Mr. Turner. And I mean, he gets under the skin of this man and gets under your skin with his performance. I mean, he's creepy, he's hawkishly intellectual, he's dangerous. But he's so dangerous and smart is David Irving that they in the real life court case and in this film, they refuse to put Deborah Lipstadt, the defendant, on the stand, and they refuse to put any Holocaust survivors on the stand. Now, a Hollywood screenwriter would have said, well, we've got to have the big moment for Rachel Weisz to get her BAFTA or Oscar clip. We've got to have, like, a, you know, an old Jewish character on the stand remembering about Auschwitz. But, you know, a Holocaust survivor would have been 60, 70, 80 years old. Mm. David Irving would have said, well, what day did you arrive? It's very hard to prove. So they buttoned their lip. And if you look at the posters for Denial that are around on the tube, and I think they're the international poster as well, the word Denial is stamped across Rachel Weisz's mouth, like a rubber stamp, which covers up half your star. And this is a strange movie that does hire a great luminous star in Rachel Weisz and then tell her to shut up. And it's very odd because the film doesn't follow those normal kind of barnstorming Aaron Brockovich-y courtroom drama moments.
Well, perhaps on that point, some critics have said it maybe lacks a degree of an emotional core, maybe. And perhaps it was so committed to bucking the normal trends or defying those usual expectations that maybe that was a concerted effort. Is that a problem
I think what it had to do was be truthful. It couldn't take artistic license and say, well, it's not, you know, like Pablo Larraín's Jackie can sort of say, well, did this happen to Jackie? We don't know because it's an interior portrait. This had to be true. I mean, David Hare wrote the script, used the transcript from the courtroom verbatim, practically verbatim, not all of it, it's 300 pages, we'd be here all night. So, you know, that's the license he can take. But if he was accused of deviating from the facts in a film about facts, then the film itself would crumble. So Mick Jackson, the director, who's had a rather strange career, he did L.A. Story, which I love, and The Bodyguard. It's a bizarre career, but and now this is a very almost sober and downplayed movie that has a massive, massive importance. And I think it's in America, it didn't do great. Tom Wilkinson, who we heard there, plays Richard Rampton, the QC. He's the only one who indulges his kind of British quirkiness and has sort of curled up sandwiches and jugs of claret in it for lunch. It hasn't got a lot of humour in it, has to be said, even though Deborah Lipstadt's a great character. I met her this week and she's, you know, to get her to button her lip is some feat, to be honest with you. She's a force of nature, as she'd have to be. And as I say, it has got a great court case in it, a great point of law arguing about facts. And of course, the relevance of that, not just because it's Holocaust denial,
I guess, in the sort of Trump's America in this post truth environment, yes, whatever you like.
And I think when they conceived the film and wrote the film, this wasn't even a thing, but alternative facts are exactly what David Irving is about presenting. And that's where we're at in a post truth world. So the film has even more relevance now than when it came out in America in the States and didn't do great. I think it's the film to watch. You know, if you don't like Hacksaw Ridge, you probably will like Denial and the other way around.
Get along to see Denial. It's out in the UK this very day. Finally, Jason, 20 years since the Scottish drug-addled cult classic Trainspotting hit the screens, we've got T2 Trainspotting, the sequel. It sees the four original characters, Renton, Spud, Sick Boy and Begbie, reunited as middle-aged men. Now, this is one of these ones, almost since the first film wrapped, people said, oh, you know, what about the sequel? Was the industry always genuinely expecting that we were going to get to this day?
Yeah, I think that there's definitely an imperative in the British industry, because, I mean, the first one changed the British film industry. It kind of energised it. It made it about marketing and soundtrack, and it brought all those disciplines together. It was galvanising and hopeful, and it started the careers of these people who are now back together. They didn't really need to do this film for their own success. Danny Boyle is Lord Danny of Boyle. You know, we love him. He's great. Ewan McGregor is Ewan McGregor. He can even take on Piers Morgan. That's how powerful he is. No, and everyone else got very famous off the back of it, including the producers of it, McDonald and John Hodge, the writer, and Christian Coulson. So they sort of had to wait a while till it became a commercial need. And that commercial is that now old people who are middle-aged go to the cinema. Young people who went to see Trainspotting probably won't. If you recapture and rebottle that energy, it's not there anymore. Youth movies are not the same. So, yeah, I wouldn't say the worldwide the industry's been waiting for Trainspotting. It's a very British success. It's a very British story, very Scottish story, in fact. Everyone wanted it to come back. I mean, you know, generations of university students had the poster on the wall and the soundtrack and everyone grew up. I mean, yes, that's my time too. But do I want to see it again? Have we changed? And that's what the T2 is about. First of all, I've got to say T2. Why is it called that?
Well, I'm thinking of Heathrow Airport or maybe the Terminator franchise.
Well, exactly.
I wasn't thinking about
neither
Renton
of them fill you with. You know, Terminator's done it already, but if you're thinking of, you know, Luton even. So I don't know why it's called that. I do know why it's called Trainspotting, which did you know why the first one was called Trainspotting? It never really kind of alluded to it.
Well, they went somewhere on a train.
They did go somewhere on a train, and probably he had trains on his bedroom wall.
Oh, that's right.
As well, don't forget.
Okay, there we go.
I think it's to do with him.
Let's have a little listen. Here's a quick extract from T2 Trainspotting.
Choose your future.
Call the police.
What shall I say?
Just tell them we're dead.
Choose reality TV, slut-shaming, revenge porn. Yeah. Choose a zero-hour contract, a two-hour journey to work, and choose the same for your kids, only worse. And smother the pain with an unknown dose of an unknown drug made in somebody's kitchen. And then, take a deep breath.
Echoes, clearly, of the original piece some 20 years on. It's funny hearing, is that Born Slippy, I think?
That is Born Slippy.
You've already mentioned this, it was the sort of soundtrack to a time, soundtrack to, I guess, transition a lot of people's lives. I sense from what you say, Jason, that we won't be having the same conversation in 20 years almost necessarily about this
picture. No, and if this were the first one, we wouldn't be having it now either. Because it is about disappointment and middle age, and I get that, and that's the idea. And it's kind of a miserable experience watching kind of, yeah, heroes from... are these heroes from my youth? Anti-heroes. Mm. They certainly not become heroes. Is the natural path for an anti-hero to then become a boring loser? Because that's what's happened. And watching four of them is quite disappointing, really, and uninteresting. None of them have kind of made any good, which is really odd because obviously all the people that made the film, who got very famous with the film, have all done good. Mm. So what there is for me, even though I'm very capable of separating the art from the work and the artist from the work, here they're so iconographic and sort of steeped in that culture. You know, Danny Boyle's Olympics ceremony was brilliant because it's the guy that did Trainspotting as well. He has used his iconography and his style to parlay a great career out of it. This film doesn't have any of that. It's obsessed with being in the past and the first film, but it doesn't have anything about this world that we're living in now, which is odd because this film was shot during Brexit in Scotland. It came out, I saw it on the day of Trump's inauguration. It doesn't mention any of that. And these people would, these characters would. So it felt that it's missed a real trick, where the first one intuited the time, predicted the time, laid down a marker for the time, captured the zeitgeist. This one feels like dad dancing and dad directing.
Oh, that's a bit of a shame, isn't it?
And I say it with the heaviest of hearts because I did not enjoy seeing these characters come back together.
But they maybe hadn't, their arc wasn't, it didn't mirror the world that maybe we thought that they were representing.
Yeah, I mean, maybe I'm out of step with it as well, but I don't think that you know, just because you were a heroin addict in the 90s, you're going to be miserable now. You might be a bit boring. You might have changed your addiction into, you know, gambling or watching golf or something. But
the one step down from a
there
serious
was no little
addiction.
Humour. And also it's shot in that Danny Boyle style. And I'm thinking, if you're making a film that's a bit more reflective and a bit sort of not youth, then don't try and recapture the editing and jumpiness of your youthful work. This was your time, Danny, to move on and mature as a film, not as a filmmaker, because he's skilled and technical and brilliant and energetic, but the subject doesn't match the shooting style. And that's when it is a bit like dad dancing, nor does the soundtrack capture the time. It feels like a little bit Six music-y and cardigan-y, Wolf Alice, a bit dull.
Just to say, I'm wearing a cardigan.
Me too.
There you go. Judge from that what you will, listeners. T2 Transporting premieres this
Chile.
Week in the UK and Ireland. It rolls out in cinemas around the world in the coming months. That's the end of today's show. What fun. Jason Solomon, thanks for being with us, as always. I'll tell you after. You've been listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Tom Edwards. The show was produced by Holly Fisher. Join us again at the same time on Monday. Jane Morris will be here talking art with us. But for now, goodbye. Thanks for listening.